Shalom. Welcome to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I am your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Seekers of Meaning is presented to help explore the impact of the longevity revolution on our congregations and our community. And we invite you to visit our website, jewishsacredaging.com, and the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. And if you'd like to send us a comment or suggestion for the podcast, send it to me, Rabbi Address, at jewishsacredaging.com. And it is with great pleasure we welcome to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, Joy Laverty, and the author of this very, very interesting, very useful, user-friendly book, Who Will Take Care of Me When I'm Old? A question that I'm beginning to ask myself more and more. So Joy, how are you? Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
We'll also be putting up the information about how to get a hold of the book and the website, etc., on the program notes that will appear when we post this particular edition of Seekers of Meaning. So, Joy, this is a great little book. It's not such a little book. Who Will Take Care of Me When I'm Old? And the subtitle, Plan Now to Safeguard Your Health and Happiness in Old Age. So you begin to talk about meeting your future self right off the bat. When I was reading the book, I was saying to myself, first chapter, I'm going to meet my future self. Why start that way?
Why start that way is because there are a lot of misconceptions and myths regarding old people. And if we live long enough, we are going to be one of them. So wouldn't it be in our best interest to get real about what that can mean for us? And that's why I started it this way. We can't make assumptions on what it's going to be like for us based on what we see portrayed in advertisements or movies, or even people we know who are not aging the way we would like to see ourselves age. This is a journey that is unique to each and every one of us. So let's get acquainted with that person.
The portrayal of older adults now, I'm fascinated in a couple of directions. Number one, I challenge this to groups that I go to and visit and work with in congregations. I said, just take a look at what's being advertised in the news hour, let's say between 6 and 7 on the East Coast, local news and the national news. It used to be cigarettes, beer, and cars a long time ago. Now, in addition to the cars, it's no longer cigarettes and not too much beer, but it's a lot of drugs. For everything that we're anticipating that we're having to deal with. And yet at the same time, and so since you alluded to this in your answer, the media seems to be catching on with the fact that if you're 78 or 80, you're alive, vibrant, sexually active, et cetera, you know, some of the Netflix stuff, some of the movies. Do you see this as how do you react to that? Are we getting two different messages from the media?
We are. And it's up to us to decide which path to go down. You also bring up another point. Be careful who you talk to. So when you go for advice regarding the medical community, are you going to a scientist, typically a doctor, or might you go another alternate route, like somebody, like a yoga teacher? So we have to pay attention to the people we use as our advisors. If they have a tendency to follow a certain regimen, might we go in that direction instead of opening our horizons for some alternative answer? I talk about this in my book. It's called Critical Thinking. So who are we going to for questions and answers? It's really important when we begin the process of planning for our future self.
So give me an example. A lot of people will refer and say, well, you should be talking to your elder care attorney, your financial planner, All of this is true, correct? Who else?
Yes. So as I alluded to, so like if you see someone who is aging vibrantly and they're engaged in life and they're 90 years old and they don't take one medication, that would be a person I would talk to for advice and say, how are you doing what you're doing?
You bottle that person.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you, that was my mother.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you have role models who are not in this medication world and not in this ill health world, then the onus is on us to begin to use them as our advisors. The doctor's fabulous. The elder law attorney, the financial planner, we need all of them, but we have to open up our advisory database to people who are aging well and find out from them, well, what are you doing? And how come you're doing so well? Because I want to know.
Right, right. And I'm sure you've run into this in the work you do. Some of it's genetic. How much is attitude?
Oh, I was just going to say, that's all there is. The people that I know that are not doing so well. So you take my friend Marty that I talk to and I write about in the beginning of the book. Marty is in his 60s. He has been living in assisted living since he has been in his 50s. He's aging solo, no family, no children. He knew that he had to be in this environment in order to age successfully. So he does not see himself as anything other than a vibrant human being, even though he has Parkinson's, he is limited to a wheelchair, and he is a reader, he is a writer, he has many friends, and he just goes forward. So just, you know, attitude, he is the epitome of attitude.
In the beginning of the book and the second chapter, you make a distinction that I want to ask you about because I found it very interesting between change and transition. You write, change is a situation or an event that happens or you make happen, but transition, on the other hand, is the psychological path one takes to adjust to the change. Unpack that, because I think it's a really important distinction.
So as you said, change is something that we either have control over or not, but change happens. So that's the part we say, okay, I accept the change. What happens after that is up to us. The successfully aging people that I know spend most of their time in the transition segment of a change. People often mistake change and transition as one and the same, but they are not. So let's say, for example, we may say, I'm in transition because I lost my job. The boss decided to fire me. Okay. So then when we go into the transition state, we might say something like, okay, what was my life like before the change? And what is my life like now? What am I saying goodbye to? What am I saying hello to? There are many questions we can ask ourselves to successfully negotiate a time when we're living in limbo, which is exactly what a transition is.
You write also in the book, one of my favorite words, because I've been guilty of this, it's called procrastination. And for those of us who went through school, undergraduate and graduate school, you know, writing the paper that was assigned 3 months ago the night before, we're familiar with this. But in the context of what you're writing about in the book, and this whole aging journey, is sometimes, in your opinion, procrastination another word for fear?
Absolutely. And I respect people's fears. That's human. I have them. Everybody has them. So when we respect that, one possible thing we can do is change that word to control. And the wonderful opportunity we have to make decisions. That's not something that is given to everyone. Sometimes it's just too darn late. But when we say control is something, it's a gift that is given to us, the right to make decisions. Now we can take a look at how we're doing self-sabotaging behavior when we procrastinate. So that's my ad, procrastination. Why would we not want to make decisions for ourselves? I suppose people have good answers. I just don't have one for myself.
But I want to just play around with this fear thing too. I mean, there's a significant amount, I think, as we get older and actually confront our own mortality of fear. I mean, do you run across this in your, when in the work that we do in Jewish Sacred Aging, when we do these workshops, especially the one on caregiving and end of life preparation, we run across three major fears: a fear of pain and suffering, a fear of outliving one's money, which is a reality in this society, and the major one, the one that pops up most, is this fear of being alone. Could you just comment on that, on what you're experiencing in your writing of the book, in your talking to groups about these types of fears?
These three fears are ever present in the room, whether someone talks about them or not, because they are the fears of living. They have to do with going on and wondering how to manage transitions that seemingly feel out of control. So it turns into fear. Everything that we fear in this case has to do a lot of times with refusing to even anticipate the possibilities. The onus is on us to research possibilities so that the fear doesn't get the best of us. When we think about pain and suffering, well, who might we go to talk about pain and suffering? Well, we certainly can talk to the medical community, but we also can talk to people who are managing their lives in spite of pain and suffering. Same holds true for the possibility of running out of money. Of all the things that is controllable, it's that one, to find out what people do when they do run out of money. Do we sit back and just fear it? Or can we go forward and begin the process of talking to the professionals like elder law attorneys and, of course, financial planners? The third one about being alone and isolated, same thing. People who are alone and isolated may have a plan that we could use to anticipate how we could possibly avert that possibility. Fear is not going to go away. It's up to us to manage the fear by getting more educated. That's my approach.
I want to pick up on something, especially this last one. I've run across this many times. And that is the person who is getting older in their 70s, let's say, who never was married, has no siblings, has no family. They are literally, according to the literature now, elder orphans. And they've expressed, you know, who, according to the title of your book, who is going to take care of me? I have no support system. I may have some very good friends, but you know, we're all heading down the same road. You do write about this in the book in a chapter called Zero Isolation, Foraging for Family. And could you just comment on this phenomenon? Because it is a growing phenomenon.
It's one in three boomers right now. And the younger population, 45 to 63, same thing. A third of that population is aging solo, as we call them. I prefer to use the word aging solo over elder orphan, because elder orphan puts us in a victim state of mind. Being solo is anything but. Mm-hmm. It's like it deserves its place in society. There are a lot of policies and procedures that are going to change. Like, for example, if you go to the doctor and he says, well, you can have this procedure, but somebody's going to have to pick you up. Well, what if you don't have anybody? So what is the healthcare industry going to do when we have no one, when they have to help us create systems of care? So in the meantime, we talk about things that we can do to to make sure that we're not alone and totally isolated. I talk a lot in my book about planning for that, possibility of volunteering. And there are some really neat volunteering opportunities that actually create families in the meantime. For example, the foster grandparent idea. You might have read about it in the book, where you could be a grandparent and then all of a sudden mm-hmm. you've got this family. It's amazing. So there are things we could do. I list many, many ideas in the book.
One of the challenges that many of us face, despite the fact that we may not want to, and you have this chapter on aging in place, which of course is, you know, the watchword now, and everybody's talking about it, and everybody's reviving the Golden Girls TV show, and isn't that one? And there's now organizations about helping to create these, but not everybody's going to be able to, quote, age in place. And for many people, the reality is that they're going to have to find a facility that they're going to have to live in for a variety of different reasons. There's a whole chapter in the book that talks about this. What piece of advice can you give to somebody who really has to walk this walk? What's the best method to choose a facility?
Well, could I just tell you that that's not necessarily what has to happen?
Sure you can. It's your book.
So that's
why I asked the question.
Okay, so that might have been the answer for the generations that came before us, but it's not the generation for the boomers and people younger. I mean, if there has ever been a generation that says, love the one you're with and, you know, we're all in this together, it's that boomer generation who doesn't think twice about living in a commune kind of setting where we're all together in this. I mean, look at Woodstock. There wasn't one crisis that happened because we just know how to take care of each other. So instead of leapfrogging into, okay, I'm going to age in place all the way to some kind of place that's an unknown, as you call, facility, to the possibility of sharing our housing. And this is the new phenomenon of the Golden Girls that's starting to pop up, where if we have a house, why not share someone? If we have a house and we want to sell it, go move in with somebody else. There's also co-living. There's also co-housing. There are all kinds of opportunities. There are jobs that we can take on in a volunteer setting that offer housing. As you alluded to, there are so many ideas in this one particular chapter that I call Where We Live Matters. And we have a lot of opportunities. And if they don't exist, we'll probably make them up. But I don't know anyone in my generation that is thinking about moving to a facility. We're just not wired that way.
No, I understand that. And for those of us of our generation who had to deal with this with our one or both of our own parents, those images are seared into our mm-hmm. memory. But the fact of the matter is, many of us are going to have to find those types of facilities for a variety of different reasons. Are people on television saying, you know, come here or do this? Is there one thing or a piece of advice that you would give? Because this talk about a major transition when the reality hits that, and we deal with this caregiving workshop all the time. I can no longer take care of my dad. I can no longer take care of my mom for their benefit, for their higher value of quality of their life, they need to go into an assisted living facility. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about how that, you know, you deal with that in the book?
Yes. And this is certainly a challenge for all of us. It's one of the toughest things about caregiving is to admit our limitations. It's really hard. So my recommendation is before any dramatic move takes place is to befriend the local assisted living communities. By doing that, you are literally surrounded by experts who understand what you're going through, and they can be so helpful in the transition process. Sometimes it's a matter of bringing services in the home before there's a major transition. My advice is become friends with the people who are working in these communities. They are so knowledgeable, they are so compassionate, and they understand what you're going through. I just can't say enough about how I rely on their expertise to get me through my rough patches.
One of the really challenging chapters, I use that word advisedly, is towards the end of the book, chapter 14, which says early onset Alzheimer's, the value of knowing, preparing for the day you hope will never come. Mm-hmm. The statistics are overwhelming now with the rise in dementia and Alzheimer's. And in truth, this is what we were alluding to just before. As these diseases progress, the best place in most cases is a facility that is trained to be able to deal with this, especially as the disease progresses. This is a major challenge for you, for us, and you write about this. It's a very important chapter. And you write about, quote, the benefit of knowing early on, unquote. Could you unpack that sentence for me? It's a very, very important phrase.
So the scientists in the medical industry is telling us that Alzheimer's is being diagnosed far earlier than we realize. People who are still working, people in their 30s, people in their 40s, certainly people in their 50s, have early onset Alzheimer's and don't know it. But it shows up in a variety of ways. We miss deadlines. We don't know how to do what we used to be able to do. And we begin to say, well, I don't know what that is. Maybe I'm just tired. I think the people who get diagnosed and say, no, this is really serious, and they make the effort to get diagnosed are the bravest people I've ever met. Because once the diagnosis comes in, it changes everything. So getting that diagnosis means you go back to the drawing board and you change everything about your plans. Every legal document is different now. Your financial plan is skyrocketing with the possibility of what you might have to pay for later on. I also talk in the book about having the conversation with other family members and friends and not being surprised at how you can watch people leave you because they don't want to deal with it. You're right. This is a condition that will affect all of us, whether we are the person who is diagnosed or not. But here's the good news. You also read in that chapter that I talk about dementia-friendly communities. What I mean by that is the possibility of being surrounded by people who have dementia is real in the world. So what would stop a government or a community or a local neighborhood to train all of us on how to become more aware of someone who is struggling with the symptoms of Alzheimer's and helping them stay vital in the community for as long as possible? People who have been diagnosed with early dementia are writing books, they're giving keynotes, they are becoming advisors for the Alzheimer's Association. They are remaining vital for as long as possible. This is something we need to go toward since it is so common in every corner of the world.
Right. I think the image of running towards it and dealing with it as opposed to running away from it in denial, because as you alluded to, and the Alzheimer's Association statistics validate this to the expected tripling in many cases of Alzheimer's dementia as baby boomers age out. and the reality that according to all the statistics and articles that I've been reading, that there are just not going to be enough trained, qualified caregivers to take care of us. So this is a societal issue in a very, very huge way, which cannot be ignored. And you're right, there are Alzheimer's friendly communities. I know there's one in Scandinavia, I forget whether it's Norway or Sweden, that's specifically been designed around this. So that this is the time has come for this to be spoken about in a much more open position.
Since you mentioned that there are professionals listening to this podcast, all of you, especially in the spiritual or the religious community, I'm a practicing Catholic. Within every church, within every temple, within every community of religious and spiritual directors, what a perfect opportunity this is to create programming within this this field where people get together and begin the process of helping each other. This is the best environment because it's the most loving, it's the most open, it is the most compassionate. Where, why not start here within our religious communities?
Well, in truth, we were involved with that as part of Jewish Sacred Aging for a long time. That more and more congregations are developing some types of friendly visitor in-reach. We call it care and community programming. I know the Catholic Church, Stevens Ministries, the Parish Nurse Program are also, because the religious communities understand that this really is at the root of why they exist, the taking care of people, that no one should be alone, no matter where they are on that journey. And you're right, this is a tremendous opportunity for churches, synagogues, mosques, religious organizations to step up to the plate and practice the values that they preach, but in a real meaningful, everyday, down in the trenches way.
Right, to focus on dementia now. Just dig deeper, that's all.
Say again?
To dig deeper.
Yes.
On this particular topic. If you make it to the age of 85, your chances of having this, and so many people continue their religious practices, you know, until the end of life.
Oh, no, that's absolutely correct. And we actually have colleagues, actually a very good friend of mine, who's turned her entire rabbinate into spiritual support for people and families dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia. So slowly but surely, and the chaplain, because it's just, you can't avoid it anymore.
Right.
It's there. You have a chapter, the title of which is great. It says, "Just Shoot Me Is Not a Plan."
I knew you were going to talk about that.
It's a great chapter. And it really talks about just the whole, well, tell me what it's about. You wrote the book. This is about plan, right? Planning?
Right. So, I mean, is ignorant bliss? Heck no. Not in this case. And we all joke around and we say, this is too tough to handle. I don't want to talk about it, but just shoot me. We hear people say that all the time. It's not a way to plan. And so, yeah, I talk about it as a way to say, come on, let's do this together. Let's really talk about it.
Well, one of the things about people should know in the book, there's a significant number in every chapter, especially in the Just Shoot Me thing, about resources, how-tos, very practical, web places, websites, books, organizations, that if you go through the book, you can't leave the book without having something that touches where you're at and what you need on a national level, a local level, resources, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
You bring up a good point because people tell me that there is so much in this book that what they're doing is they're going to the table of contents. And this is what I also recommend because there's so much. Go to the table of contents, pick something you want to deal with, open it to that chapter, take a look. Even if it's just a paragraph, make a plan on what you just read, close the book, put it back on your nightstand and go do it. And then when you're ready, open it up again and deal with something else. This is not a book you sit down and read in your cozy little reading chair and then particularly on your bookshelf. This is a book that will continuously come into play every time you want to plan for a transition or something happens.
Right. This is not a beach book, but it's a book that over the course of years will be doggy-eared, underlined.
Yeah.
And that's the way it should be. Joy Laverty, the author of Who Will Take Care of Me When I'm Old, and a reminder, will include Joy's contact information and how people can get the book right on the page for this podcast of on the Jewish Sacred Aging website and the Facebook page. So that information will be there. Before we run out of time, I have to ask you this one question, because this brought a chuckle, and itself is probably a good dinner party conversation starter. In that, at the end of each chapter, you you list a song and a movie yeah. that speaks to the chapter, and at the end you have a recommended songs, etc. Sort of like a playlist. Now we could spend hours arguing about the songs that you pick. Why the Bee Gees is on there? I have no idea. But
Staying alive, man. I mean,
what I last question, because this is it's for, and the movies itself. I mean, and the first chapter's movie is The Big Chill, and for the Just Shoot Me chapter, I think you have that a great movie Up. The first 10 minutes of which is a class. I've shown it to classes in the rabbinic seminary that I teach on this stuff. So it's a great film. But what drew you to include the songs and the films?
I will tell you, I was writing my book and my brother walked in the room. My brother is 2 years younger than myself. We're both boomers. There's 5 children in the family and we're very close. I'm in the middle. My brother is next. And we all, being a large Italian family, we're constantly telling each other what to do. My brother walks in the room and he said, "Hey, you know this book you're writing, right?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "You can't write a book geared toward boomers planning without having music in it. You'd be crazy if you didn't have music in it." And I said, "God, are you right?" And so my brother put the bug in my ear and he said, "It will add so much to the book." And he's right. And I had so much fun figuring out what should I list as a playlist.
Well, I'm telling you, you get a dinner party and give them just a list of the songs and the movies and just turn them loose and see what, because I'm looking at the thing and I'm saying, wait a minute, where's the Circle Game in there? Both Sides Now, the Joni Mitchell thing, is a classic.
Yeah.
But there's no Beatles songs, is there? I mean,
there's one Beatles song. But see, the thing is these are all boomer songs. And boy, don't we know that we just ate singing and music for breakfast.
Well, and the soundtrack of The Big Chill. I mean, you have the soundtrack of that movie in itself is classic. But anyway, as I said, we could spend a lot of time arguing over films and music. But thank you, Joy. Joy Laverty, Who Will Take Care of Me When I'm Old? Thank you very much for joining us here on today's edition of Seekers of Meaning. Continued good luck with the book and just stay healthy. Thank you very, very much, Joy, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. And again, we welcome your comments and suggestions to rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And we invite you as well to continue to visit and like our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. We appreciate all of your support. And if you would like to make a tax-exempt donation to help further the work of Jewish Sacred Aging and the Seekers of Meaning podcast, we invite you to go to the website, jewishsacredaging.com. Click on the donate icon at the top of the page. We gratefully appreciate your support. Seekers of Meaning is recorded here at the studios of Lubetkin Media Companies here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And we thank our producer, Steve Lubetkin. Thank you again for listening. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I look forward to greeting you on our next Seekers of Meaning. Shalom.